Hello from our Zurich Bureau and welcome to Sunday Brunch here on Monocle 24 with me, Georgina Godwin. Coming up...
Zurich is a very wealthy society, but it is also a city for all groups, very different groups of people, a city for all, I call it.
We speak to the guitar-playing, bike-riding Karina Mauck, the mayor of Zurich. We'll also be exploring the city's food and drink scene and taking a plunge into the world of outdoor swimming. And it may seem obvious, but it took a while for one of Sweden's greatest exports to get a dedicated space.
All the tourists coming to Stockholm asked about the ABBA Museum, and the Swedish tourist board and everyone had to say, sorry, there is none. What? You don't have an ABBA Museum. This country is ABBA.
I'll be taking you behind the scenes at the ABBA Museum in Stockholm. Plus, Cornelia Mayer will be going through the weekend papers. All that's come this hour, live from Zurich, with me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24. Now, to begin today's show, I'm pleased to say that I'm joined by a couple of people. Fernando Augusto Pacheco is sitting in with me, and one of the reasons I think he's here is that Chandra Kurt is with us. Now, she is the editor of the Wine Cellar Journal, and wherever Chandra is, there's generally a glass of wine to be had. It might be a little bit early for us, but you know what? It's slightly later in Zurich. Can we justify drinking, Fernando?
I think it's always justifiable, you know, it's for work purposes, right?
Yeah, always, so, when I'm here, it's always work.
Of course.
So, Chandra, you are more than welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Chandra is, of course, a big wine expert, particularly on Swiss wine. She's contributed to many, many journals that tell us all about wine. She's the editor, as I say, of Wine Cellar Journal. And really, I think it's fair to say it's your life's work.
It's my life's work. And the beauty about it, it's all over the planet. You know, people produce wine, people drink wine. So I keep on traveling all over, meeting new people, and of course drinking all the time some wine.
Well, we've been really impressed for our time here in Zurich by the food and drink. I mean, we've been to some absolutely stunning restaurants, had some really great food here, and wine. There hasn't been as much Swiss wine as I imagined there would be. How big is the industry?
Well, the industry is very big because Swiss people drink a lot of wine. They drink approximately like 35 liters. To put it in a relativity, in Germany you drink maybe 20 liters, in the States also 20, in Italy you drink 45. So the Swiss people drink a lot of wine, but they drink half of the consumption is the Swiss wine. This is why we hardly export wine, because all the wine is drunk in the country, and we import a lot of wine, mainly from Italy, from France, from Spain, from South America. So the interest in wine was always very big here.
Mm. And now, speaking of South America, I know that you've just returned, and actually before you went, you had a chat with Fernando, didn't you?
Yeah, we had, I believe I gave you some
tips,
right?
You gave me fantastic tips. You know,
were they good?
They were fantastic. I mean, the Fasano in Sao Paulo was really my favorite place, and so I went to Sao Paulo, but the trip was to go to Argentina it's an elderly wine project of the Swiss family of Donald Hess. They planted the highest vineyard on the world on 3,150 meters. I was a little bit afraid to go so high, because usually, you know, when you are so high, the alcohol has another impact, but all went well, and on the way back I stopped again in Sao Paulo, and what a beautiful place.
Is it it's true that, you know, the Brazilian wine industry is growing? Do you see a potential there?
Yeah, of course, because, you know, you have this Mediterranean somehow impact, and meaning you have a food that goes well with wine, and wine is a cultural pleasure, so of course.
Tell us what you've got in front of you. I'm trying to get back to the wine on the table. You'll notice
I always have some bottles in the back. Yes.
Tell us what you have and what's special about them.
So I brought the white wine from Argentina, which is from this Swiss project, and the grapes grow on 2,700 meter. Can you imagine that in Switzerland the highest vineyard is on 1,100, and they go 2,700? So it's a much more, you know, the relation between sunshine and grape skin, it's completely different, and because of climate change that we have, it will come more and more that growers go higher, that you need more the freshness of the night. So I brought something I didn't taste it yet. It's called Misterioso, so from Colomé Estate in Argentina. And then I brought something I do here in Switzerland, which is my project. It's the Dole. It's a very traditional wine from the Valais, from our highest region, and it's a light, gentle wine for lunchtime. So it's a mixture of Pinot Noir and Gamay, so something to start the day easily.
Mm-hmm. Well, as it's a light lunch lunchtime wine. I think we could possibly try it, could we?
This we can do, yes. I even have a bottle opener, or somebody can open.
Yeah, well, I think our producer, Reese, is happy to jump in there and help us open the bottle, because
open
it's definitely time to try. Chandra, tell us about that project, about that second bottle, because as you say, that's something that you are very involved with.
Yes, so it's, Dole is a name. It's not a grape, it's a name, and usually it's Pinot Noir and Camay, and it's you'd only find it in the region of the Valais, which is the biggest wine region of Switzerland. It has a third of all our vineyards on 5,000 hectares, and it's a blend. So every house can do a different blend, can do it a little bit stronger or a bit lighter. And my idea was to go back to the ancient times when the Dole was a lighter wine, because there are so many modern wine and heavy wines that our palate sometimes gets tired of all this sweetness and aromas. So to have something more gentle, more easy to drink, well, I prefer it. So I usually do create wines that I love to drink.
Mm. And what would you eat with that?
Because it's a light red wine, you can of course have like poultry or chicken or light dishes, but you can even do fish. And I think to have a red wine for fish is always something that you can use at home.
Yeah. So I see that three of us now have not managed to open this bottle. So I think as you talk, you open the bottle for us, because it's actually, as you were saying, light food. But that's something that I haven't found a lot of here in Zurich, Fernando. Wouldn't you say the food has been absolutely delicious, but I wouldn't have called it light.
I wouldn't call it, it's very carb heavy, but I think that's wonderful in a way. But the Swiss, they have good salads. I think if you look around, but yeah, I have to be honest, I was dying to have lots of roasty and sauce. I love roasty so much, it's weird because sometimes I order an extra portion at restaurants as well. Mm-hmm. But Chandra, just coming back to the industry of wine, I'm very curious because, Georgina, I don't know if you noticed, in the UK, all the publications are talking about orange wine, for example.
Yeah.
Is the wine industry a bit like fashion in a way, kind of moved by those kind of trends, because suddenly you see articles about orange wine everywhere, if you know what I mean. What would you say about that,
well,
Chandra?
This is a very, very interesting question, and I think the orange, the wine, is a very actual movement in wine. And it's funny that you mentioned the fashion industry, because orange wine is the opposite of establishment.
Mm-hmm.
So it's mainly in you have it in the city, a big movement. It comes from France and Italy, and it's like the new generation of wine drinkers that are very aware of environment, of the nature, of where they live, of preserving all the goods of your origin. They have enough of in a way the fine wine, the high brands that are very important, very, very commercial all over, and also the industry wines. And they say, let's go back in wine production, how the Asian people did it, how our grandparents and even the people before did it. And in a way, what they do, they create wine by letting nature do its work. The result is not always good, but some wines can be extraordinary. And when you drink it, you have to know a lot about it, because it doesn't taste like usual wine. So a normal wine person will be maybe a little bit shocked, because it smells maybe more like cider or like a beer. And it looks like you say, orange, because you have a long skin contact, and then this gives this color. So it's like orangely brown. But myself, I must admit, I started to enjoy this wine a lot, because it's, like you say, it's a new style of wine.
And I haven't
now
tried.
Reese is just pouring us a little taste. I think that's fine.
We start with the white wine.
This is the white.
This is so from Argentina, from Bodegas Colomé on 2,700 meter. And let's see, it just came home yesterday. Let's see if it's good.
Ooh. People say that wine doesn't travel, that the minute you put it on an aeroplane, it starts to lose.
Well, I think that the main, let's say, wisdom in this sentence is that you don't travel, or you are different when you're in the origin of the place of the wine. Usually you smell the air, you love the place, you see the vineyards, and immediately the wine is better.
Yeah.
Than when you sit maybe in a boring place or you're alone and at home and you don't have all this imagination.
Mm.
But But of course, there are some more simple wines that I would also suggest not to take them in the luggage, but to leave them in the place.
I'm a fan, actually, I have to say. It's lovely, good in the morning, I've got to be honest. It's quite fresh.
Well, when you get used a little bit to Switzerland, you know that, especially in the French part, from 10:30 in the morning, they don't serve coffee anymore, but they drink white wine.
I'm moving here.
Yeah, me too. I think it's always a good idea.
It's tremendously civilized, isn't it? It really is. So this is the white, and then so the other is...
Then shall we maybe...
Yeah.
So let's do like this. You can pour this here.
Yeah. What a waste, unfortunately. But let's do that, just to have a quick taste of this one. Now, this is the one from...
From the Valais, from the French-speaking part. Blend of Pinot and Gamay, so you see the color is
very light. It's very light for a red, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes, sir.
That's good.
It has a light fruity taste, like some strawberries, a little peppery note. It's gentle on the tongue, and it's you have it a little bit chilled. Usually I serve it a little bit chilled, and you can have some light dishes.
Well, I think it's absolutely delicious. Chandra, thank you so much for coming in. Just before we go, I know that you have many books out, but just tell us the title of your latest one and where it's available.
Well, the latest is coming out in 3 weeks. It's called The Wine Cellar. It's the book to the magazine, and it is a wine cellar. And it's a description of about 600 wines you can buy for daily consumption. So you will find the wines you need.
And when is the next issue out?
The next issue is beginning of December.
I look forward to it.
About the Argentinian winery.
Fantastic. Chandra, thank you so much for coming in. That's Chandra Kurt. Now, still to come on the programme, outdoor swimming, ABBA, and my sit-down interview with the charismatic mayor of Zurich. What more could you ask for? Perhaps another glass of wine. Stay tuned.
Monocle's entrepreneurial September issue is jam-packed with advice, wisdom, and heartening tales of the folks around the world who are building better businesses. We meet the startups pursuing careers in everything from sharpening up the stationery business to surfers helping recycle ocean plastic, and mull over why starting older is sometimes better for business. And if the working world isn't for you, well, then there's a career in the French Foreign Legion to consider. Elsewhere, we discuss the late Francisco Franco's next move, visit a seemly startup space in Provence, and bed down in a Danish residence par excellence. We also take you on a design-minded tour of a Tokyo restaurant opening that you may well have heard about, and talk trainers with the man behind New Balance. We also sip wine in Kefalonia before a last meal with the Beirut cookbook author, Anissa Helou. The opportunity-filled September issue of Monocle is on all good newsstands now.
It's 14 minutes past the top of the hour. You're listening to Sunday Brunch, coming to you live from Zurich. I'm Georgina Godwin. I'm joined in the studio by my colleague Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and now by Adrian Snodgrass, because everywhere we've been, people have been raving about the lake and taking off their clothes at the slightest opportunity and diving in. And of course, that's one thing you can't escape in Zurich, is outdoor swimming. So Adrian is from the Outdoor Swimming Society. What is it, Adrian?
It's a society to promote swimming outdoors, simply, to try and counteract. I think when I was a child, at least, there was sort of bad press that, especially in the UK, it wasn't a place that was safe to swim outdoors, that it could be dangerous, there could be pollution, that kind of thing. Mm. Obviously, that's not an issue here in Zurich, but that's the mission, quite simply.
Are you based here in Zurich?
I'm based in Zurich, yeah.
Because of the lake? Because of the outdoor swimming?
It was a very big draw. I'm lucky to live about 200 metres from the lake, and I can walk 5 minutes and jump in.
Yeah.
Do you think Zurich is one of the best cities that do well when it comes to wild swimming? Like, because, you know, I think that's, you know, at Monaco we always talk that, you know, cities like London, Paris should do more, you know, for wild swimming. They should create more parks, easier access to lakes and everything. Do you think Zurich does well? And people could learn from what Zurich does to that?
Definitely. I think there's a combination of access to the water itself. It's affordable. Anybody can do it. You don't need any equipment. The main thing is it is clean. There's no doubt that there's no danger in the water. I saw a huge fish yesterday, but I mean, it's a fish. It's not an issue. Definitely, there's a sort of zeitgeist at the moment where London is, I wouldn't say catching up, because I'd say the swimming communities have been parallel in both places. I would suggest that perhaps more people do it in Zurich, especially on a lunch break, before work, after work. It's just so easy. And again, the cleanliness, it's not like salt water. You can have a swim and just get changed afterwards. You don't need to have a shower. You're not going to itch or that kind of thing.
Do you work together with the city of Zurich in any way or form? Or?
I don't personally, but with our swimming group, we have sometimes contacted the police to ask about safety, that kind of thing. So we've definitely had some tips as to what's advisable and inadvisable.
Mm. One thing that I've been struck by is the whole kind of social aspect around swimming here. And there are all, I forget the word for it, there's a lovely word for these kind of places that exist on the side of the lake where you go not only to swim from, but also to have your coffee or
the
your
buddies.
Lunch.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that social side of it.
Yeah, that's a good question. That's sort of half of the appeal for many. Initially, I swam on my own, and of course that's is a safety risk, even if you're a really good swimmer, because you don't know what could happen. Chances are it won't. But then if you swim with a group, you have that camaraderie, you learn to swim with other people if you are a competitor, because a lot of the people here are triathletes and that kind of thing. But then afterwards you have the normally good restaurants and cafes and associated amenities that the Bardis contain, so you can sit down, have a gipfel, have a coffee and just start your day the right way. Fitness is done, and then have your breakfast, go to work.
As soon as we're done here, in fact, Georgine, I'm going for a swim at the Utoke, which is, you know, 5 minutes here from the office. Do you have any tips for someone who's coming to Zurich? Where should they go? I mean, the Utoke is quite a nice one, right?
Utoke is my favorite Bardi. If I'm swimming on my own, it's Utoke. I like the deck. I like the cafe. It has a, you feel a little bit like you're on holiday.
Mm-hmm.
Each one has a different sort of atmosphere. So if you want to go with your family, Mittenkay is full of families, slides, things to play on. Hiltel restaurant there as well. There's the Frauenbadi, which is one of the first ones along with Utoke. There's the Männerbadi on the river further in the city. There's a beautiful new one called Hoyried, which is inland a little bit there. The city spent $8 million, I think, renovating this one.
And all of this is free. I mean, unless you buy a coffee or whatever. But I mean, it's absolute free access to the lake, isn't it?
Relatively free. You pay an annual Sportamt subscription. But for Zurich, you may as well call it free. It's around 100 francs. For the summer, I think it's 200 francs for the year to use any pool, and you can see in an expensive city that's next to nothing for the cost.
Yeah, are you going off for a swim now?
That's why my bag's with me.
You should come with us, Georgina, after.
Yeah, I'm wedded to the studio, but at least I have a glass of wine, so that's okay. You guys go off and be healthy. I'll just get quietly sozzled here behind the microphone. Adrian, thank you so much. That
Your
was
pleasure.
Adrian
Thank you.
Snodgrass. You are listening to Sunday Brunch. Now, I have been enormously impressed by the efficiency of Zurich, so I thought I'd pop down to City Hall and meet the woman responsible for running it. Karina Mauck is the mayor, and here she talks about her dream projects for the city.
In the basement of the buildings, we need to have public queues, we need to have restaurants, we need to have stores, otherwise you have dead areas, and this really, it's being shown there that this works. If we talk about Europalé, maybe we can mention Manegg. This is a large district in the south of the city of Zurich, which is strongly oriented toward the principle of the so-called 2000-watt society. It is developed. Everything is oriented towards this principle of 2000-watt, with green spaces, with very good isolation of the houses, with renewable energy, with transportation solutions. So this is becoming now a very interesting, very new part of our city in the south. if I am asked, we were talking about we have a very high quality of life. Zurich is a very attractive city. The rankings are, year after year, are very good rankings our city gets. So the answer to this question is not, oh, yes, we have a problem here, we have a problem here, we have to change everything. But what we have to say, yes, I think what we have to take care of is that this good situation we are in is not becoming a situation somehow stuck that we say, okay, we're very well off, so let's lay back and don't do anything. But we have to stay also dynamic. We have to observe the challenges that are coming. For example, digitization is really so strongly changing the society. And therefore, Zurich is today also is a very wealthy society, but it is also a city for all groups, very different groups of people, a city for all, I call it, a solidarity city. And we have to invest because the price pressure on the ground, for example, is very high. Prices of the housing, of the apartments are rising. And we are talking about gentrification, which is taking place in some places. Houses are renovated and people move out. They can't afford to go back into this house. Other people come in, which are more highly educated, are richer than the people that left. And we want to take care that we stay, even if this pressure is high, we stay a city where all parts of the population find a place to live. They can find affordable housing is therefore a very important issue for us because we are convinced we also have a very high level of security. You really can feel safe in the city of Zurich. And we are convinced that is very strongly a result also of this. We have a very mixed city structure. We don't have one area where there are only very poor, low-educated people, which with a high rate of jobless people, and other regions where there are districts where there are only the rich people, but it is very mixed. The entire city structure is very mixed, and we are sure that this mixing of different people, different groups of people, and also in the economic sense, large companies and small companies, small stores, this really contributes to this functioning and this safety that we have in our city. So I think these are all issues we have, all the qualities Zurich have. I said it is a result of investing in the city, and we have to continue investing in the city.
And making it open for business to all, to small startups, for instance, to entrepreneurs.
This has become, after the crisis I mentioned of the 90s, the creative sector has become very, very important during the past years. And it really holds a substantial portion on the jobs we have in Zurich, on attractive jobs we have in Zurich, and also on the companies. So this is something also I can refer to, this price pressure on the ground. We know that, especially for startups, it is crucial that they find places to be, to find a bureau or an atelier, which they can pay, which they can afford. And since the price pressure is very high, we have had the opportunity, and we have also did it, that the Swiss Railway Association has very large central areas which are no longer used in the coming years. Europa Allee is such an area which are no longer used for the company as railway areas. So they are getting free. We can plan what we want to do there. Some of them were zoned as industrial zones. So when you have an industrial zoning, the price of the land is much lower than if you can build 6-7 floor high buildings on it. And we decided that we want to let it stay in the industrial zone, and together with the Swiss Railway Association in the Areal Werkstätte, it's called, where some years past trains were repaired, but it's no longer, they don't need it anymore. We have created now space for new companies, for manufacturing companies, for startups, for creative ideas. For example, one company is there, they want to brew their beer. They already brew beer in another place in Zurich, and they have organic material. And next to them, there is a startup which produces out of organic plastic. And so they say, okay, we can deliver our organic material to you, and you can, with a very high-tech startup, a very sophisticated sophisticated startup process they can produce. So this is an area, I think it's very important for a city to have such areas where future models of production, of manufacturing in urban areas can develop, can. And for this you need the place, for this you need low-cost land, and for this you need freedom of the use of the land. We also had to realize that our zoning plans, which say, well, this is a zone for housing, this is a zone for loud industry, and this is a zone for banks, it doesn't work with this new creative startup scene and new ways of economic processes, because this all goes together. They develop something, they have a showroom, they produce something, but they also sell their things there. And we have to also revise our zoning regulations to make possible to happen what happens in the evolution with the new developments.
Your party has been in power within Zurich for a long time. You have a lot of support here. Obviously, when we look around Europe at the wider political picture, we're seeing that slip away in many ways, a big turn to the right. And I wonder if you're seeing a big divide between the citizens and voters of Zurich, of the city, and a disconnect between that, what people lazily call the liberal metropolitan elite, and the rest of the country.
Yes, I think this is something that's happening at the moment. I think it's happening in Switzerland, a divide between urban areas, not only cities, urban areas, and the areas around. I think it has to do with this urban lifestyle and another much more conservative lifestyle. It has also to do with globalization and the fear of being a loser in this process of globalization. But it's also something that's happening worldwide, I think, and in Europe. I launched, together with 10 colleagues, the mayors of the 10 largest cities in Switzerland, the idea of launching a national exhibition in the next 5 to 10 years, where we want to talk about this. How do we want to live together in the future? Because this divide is getting larger, but we know that in the functional room, we can only work together. Zurich would never be Zurich what it is if we didn't have the other areas around Zurich, with the landscape, with the Zurich Oberland, where you can go hiking and it's wonderful. And the areas around, they wouldn't have the strength they have if they didn't have the city of Zurich in the center. So we have to get aware of this, and we have to get also into a dialogue of what are our different functions and what are our interests, and respect, okay, you have different interests, we have our interests, but we are very strongly interconnected. And I think the Swiss system of direct democracy helps to be closer to the basis, closer to the population, which can vote on very concrete projects and on regulations and say, yes, we want this, or no, we don't want this. It makes possible that we are in closer interaction, I think, with the basis. But it still is really an issue and a challenge for us, and it will stay one in the future.
And that was the mayor of Zurich, Corinne Mauch. And incidentally, she plays a mean bass guitar. The Museum of Things in Berlin documents the product culture of the 20th and 21st centuries with its huge collection of everyday objects. It's currently hosting an exhibition called The Eroticism of Things that draws on historical collections to explore how and why objects become eroticized. Monocle contributor Henry Rees-Sheridan met with the exhibition's co-curator, Hannes Hacker, from the Research Center for the Cultural History of Sexuality at Humboldt University to discuss the collection.
So this exhibition is taking place in the context of the 150th anniversary of the birthday of Magnus Hirschfeld, who was an important sexologist and a pioneer of the German gay rights movement in the early 20th century. And he built up also a collection at his Institute of Sexology that he founded in 1919, the first institute for sexology in the world. This for us was a starting point in this for this exhibition to look at three different collectors who all collected erotic things, things of sexual erotic nature, objects and things connected to sexuality and eroticism. They are Magnus Hirschfeld and Alfred Kinsey, two sexologists, and Naomi Wilczyk, who's an art collector who founded her own museum. Now, the collection of Magnus Hirschfeld doesn't exist anymore. It was destroyed in 1933 by the Nazis or Nazi students, and a lot of his books were burnt in the book burning. And so we only have records, photos, and so forth to discern what was in the collection of Magnus Hirschfeld, actually. With his collecting, he kind of wanted to support his thesis of the intermediary sexes, is what he called them. So his theory that there's an infinite variability of gender around the world and of sexuality. He was very much engaged for the homosexual movement, for the decriminalization of homosexuality, but he also fought for the right for abortion and for women's rights to vote, and so forth. So he collected objects from all around the world that would document the variability of sexuality and gender.
A really fundamental theme of this exhibition is the boundary between pornography and eroticism, the acceptable and the unacceptable. And it's so interesting looking around this room full of erotic objects that, you know, so many objects which would have been considered pornographic, you know, even as late as the 60s, are now kind of hilariously kitsch. They're not titillating in the least. But there's also, it kind of cuts both ways, right? Because there are also a kind of explicit depictions of particularly female sexuality in some of the older objects that wouldn't be acceptable today. So it's a really interesting lens through which to kind of track changing social norms in that regard, with regards to taste and what's appropriate, what's inappropriate.
Yeah, I think especially the division or the nowadays seemingly obvious or clear distinction between eroticism and pornography or erotic art or pornography or, well, whatever these kind of juxtapositions may be, is that when we look at history, this is a very fraught relationship or a distinction that has been changing and is still constantly being debated. So we have two examples in our exhibition that speak to this questioning of the boundary between eroticism and pornography. So we have one object that is a sugar bowl by a German company, Kala, which was designed by Barbara Schmidt, and it has a cone form. And so she designed it and it was sold in Germany, and then she wanted to market it or wanted to sell it on the American market, and the distributor kind of, you know, didn't quite get the word out. It was kind of complicated, the discussions they were having, and it turned out, well, actually the sugar bowl was deemed too phallic for the American market, so she had to design a new flat lid for the sugar bowl that we also have on display, the flat lid, and she called it the castration of the sugar bowl that happened there. And I think that speaks very interesting exactly to the thing, well, how can a sugar bowl be deemed pornographic or obscene? Another example that we have is a video by Stephanie Sale. She's an artist that works mostly online. She does videos, she posts videos, or in her art you see her hands fingering, fondling, touching fruit in all kinds of ways, also penetrating fruit, mashing, smushing, erotically engaging or caressingly loving, I mean, whatever words you can find for this. And even though you always only see her hands and fruit, her videos have been banned from website, have been taken down, have been censored because they've been deemed too pornographic, too obscene. And so I think that even though it's only fruit and hands, still the imagination of the viewer and the term of what is acceptable, what is not acceptable, is still relevant today and is still being debated. I mean, when you look at the censoring of female nipples in digital media, male nipples never get censored. Why not? So there's a gender imbalance there. And I think, I mean, for us, it's very interesting also the question exactly that eroticism of things is an active thing. It's eroticizing things. That can be fantasy, that can be actual touch, that can be, any kind of different way of how we interact with these objects.
You've presented the fetish objects alongside a cabinet of household objects. So, you know, a wire brush, a spray bottle, some clothes pegs, which can be used or have been used to erotic ends. What's the difference between, you know, a gas mask, which has been appropriated by fetish culture, and a clothes peg? One of them has been eroticized so explicitly that it's very difficult to look at one and not kind of think about sexuality. What's the difference between those two categories of objects?
Yeah, I think that was exactly the reason for juxtaposing these two. So there are some materials and objects that we immediately associate with fetishism, that is leather, that is latex, that is rubber. But there are other objects that we've termed tools of pleasure that are not fetish objects in that sense that sexuality has to necessarily evolve around it, but more, you know, maybe an opportunity for the visitors to actually question and think about these objects and in which way would they be used? How can they become tools of pleasure? Would they be in interaction? Would that just be by touching them or fondling them or looking at them? And also to think of how everyday activities become eroticized, and we have objects in there that we don't even know what they are. So actually to get people's imagination going and to, again, to make people think about the relation that we have to things, and that the eroticization of things is an active tasks that people undertake in all kinds of settings. And I mean, one thing that we have is the nozzle of a vacuum cleaner. And I mean, it is documented that a lot of injuries occur with people using a vacuum cleaner and the nozzle for sexual pleasure and then hurting themselves in the course of it. But we have other, objects in here, as you said, that would, spike people's interest in the materiality of things. So we have a wire brush next to a feather fan. And I think that also shows how different kind of materials spike different kind of erotic imaginaries, different kind of erotic fantasies, and maybe also different practices. And some people would say, well, what is this doing here? And others would say, well, of course, yeah, clearly, this is a tool of pleasure.
That was Hannes Hacker speaking to Henry Rhys Sheridan. Natalie Galpin co-produced that report. The Eroticism of Things runs at the Museum of Things in Berlin until October the 1st.
Tired of seeing the same few tedious tourist haunts?
Well, the Monocle Travel Guide series has stopped off in 30-plus cities and counting in order to dispense advice on travelling like a local. From the finest spot in which to sip a cocktail with a contact, work up a sweat, or take a dip, our comprehensive travel guide series are packed with tips, essays, and tidbits for getting the very best from your destination. Monocle's Travel Guide series is published by Gestalten. We've recently added Mexico City and Zurich, Basel and Geneva to the library, with Athens and Helsinki coming soon, and guides to Chicago and Hamburg following early next year. The Monocle Travel Guide series. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
It's Sunday Brunch, coming to you live from Zurich with me, Georgina Godwin, and my colleague Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And we're now joined in the studio by Cornelia Mayer. Now, she's the CEO of the business consultancy Mayer Resources, and she's here to have a look through the papers. Thank you for coming in.
Well, thank you for having me. It's exciting days to be in Zurich.
Very exciting days, particularly to be in a place that revolves so much around finance, because, of course, 10 years ago, exactly, the world was facing a crash. Yeah. Where are we now?
Well, I've taken an article, a leader from the Finanz und Wirtschaft, which is a Swiss newspaper, which is sort of like what The Economist is to the English-speaking world, it's to the German-speaking world. And in terms of transparency, I do write leaders for them as well. But this is a far more intelligent man called Clifford Padevitt, who wrote the article, and he said, look, we are still a little bit in the remnants of the crisis, and if he looks at things like global debt, if he adds the debt of the national debt of countries and the debt of private households, we are at 318% of GDP, and we are not going down anytime soon because the interest rates are so low. So when the interest rates go up, that will really hurt. And he also says, look, what was not tested was the new measures for banks. We have better capitalization, yes, but will the new measures in case of a bad failure, will those things really work through? And he very rightly makes the comment in terms of of the European banks, that of the euro-denominated banks, that, you know, there is it's still so much country-based, and there is no insurance scheme, so it's very hard for consolidation. Now, I would argue to that, do we really want too much consolidation? Because if our banks get too big, they really pose systemic risks.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. In terms of the fallout from 2008, I wonder if we're feeling it politically in this huge swing to the right we're seeing everywhere, that 2008 is perhaps in some way responsible for bringing us Donald Trump and everything that followed.
I think yes, and I think people are rightfully angry that, you know, we saved the bankers, but we didn't do a lot. Mm. And it's not just the right, you know, we see the, especially in Germany, we see the AfD, but we also see the more left parties like the Linke, the former communists in Germany, or the left party in Sweden, who just did very well. And those guys say, look, they're really worried what will happen to people in the old age. Nobody can get on the housing ladder. And on continental Europe, housing ladder, it's not like the UK where you own the house, means even the renting ladder. So you can't get on the housing ladder. You're worried about the nation, the welfare state. And perversely, that helped the Swedish, that helped the Swedes. The Swedish right-wing party, very much the Sweden Democrats, because they said, oh, we have this wonderful welfare states, we have all these immigrants, now we won't have hospitals, places, we won't have places in the creches. So perversely, it's the sustainability of the welfare state that continental Europe has become so used to is at danger.
Mm. We could talk about that for a very long time, but I think we should move on to these extraordinary Swiss spying claims. Now, this is actually not a new story, but it's only just come to light.
Yeah, it's not a new story, and it's the Sonntagszeitung, which I think every Swiss household reads. When I'm in Switzerland, I read it. When I'm not in Switzerland, I clearly don't read it. But it's they say every fourth Russian diplomat in the country is a Russian spy. And they had especially during the doping scandal, there's the doping, the WADA, the World Anti-Doping Agency, which is in Lausanne. They had honed in on that, on their secret meetings. There's in Spiez, there is a laboratory for chemical warfare. And actually, the Novichok got identified at that laboratory. It's probably the best laboratory, certainly in Europe, if not the world, in terms of, you know, they have all sorts of terribly clever chemists and people in there. They also spied on that. Notably, the two suspects that we have identified in the UK have spent a month, I think, in Geneva before doing their deed. Mm. So that's quite interesting.
Very interesting. And of course, those suspects have come out and given a television interview, haven't they?
Yes.
Saying, we were just tourists, it wasn't us.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's reminiscent of when we had the hacking scandal and Vladimir Putin came out and said, oh, you know, I haven't instructed anybody, but if I have patriotic friends who know something about hacking, can I stop them?
Absolutely. It's really back to Thomas A. Beckett, who will rid me of this turbulent priest. It's been going on for years.
Absolutely.
And Cornelia, I have a question for you. I mean, I'm very interested, of course, in the Swiss dailies. I mean, if someone that doesn't know how's the newspaper industry here, how would you divide the papers?
Well,
so what are the more kind of serious, the more tabloidy types?
I think that the really very good one is the NZZ, the Neue Zürcher Zeitung. That is sort of the time. So maybe you have a little bit more financial coverage. But in terms of financial and economic coverage, I would say the Finanz und Wirtschaft is very good. Handelsblatt is very good. Then you have the Sonntagszeitung. Then you have the Blick. That would be the Sun. Right. Mm. But you also have, we're four languages and three official languages. So we have the Tribune de Genève. You have a very nice French speaking newspaper and one from Lausanne. And then obviously we have also in the Ticino. So it's quite an interesting landscape, but it's very, very tough because it's a small market. It may be an affluent market, but it's a really small market. You know, if you you have the Financial Times. You essentially have the world reading you. Now, Finanz und Wirtschaft as well, because I think there is no serious player in industry or banking in the German-speaking world who will not read the the Finanz und Wirtschaft.
Now, if there's one thing that the Swiss are very, very good at, it's referendums. They seem to have a referendum.
They are very good.
Drop of a hat. However, the same cannot be said about the UK, which has just proved it's really quite bad at referendums. But the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, is now finally come out and actually said there should be a second referendum on Brexit. Now, this is so interesting because people have been pushing for this for a long time, but nobody's actually come out and of any authority come out and said that. And it seems to be that they were waiting for the figures. People needed those figures to come out where it would be 60-40 in favour of having a new referendum. And Sadiq Khan has clearly made that call and come out with this big piece in The Observer.
Yeah, and he says there, nobody had voted to make themselves poorer. They hadn't voted to make their businesses less safe and to have the NHS understaffed. That's so pretty much what he said. And he very much, but he's very London-centric, obviously. And we had the people, especially the Remainers in the Conservative Party, have been pushing for it. Then we had the Gina Miller initiative, where she went to the courts and actually forced at least a vote in Parliament, and he came out. What I found interesting about him coming out is you may have seen yesterday Emily Thornberry, the Shadow Foreign Secretary, came out in the Financial Times saying, "Oh, I don't want the referendum. I think we can only get a bad deal." She says anything that doesn't keep the UK at the same level as if we were still in the single market and in the customs union, which is not possible because if we're leaving, is a bad deal for Britain. And she would rather have the people vote in a general election, obviously, because she thinks Labour could get in. All of this, I have to say, politicians should stop squabbling and get together because they have to start putting country before party. Mm. And the question with the referendum is, how are you going to phrase it? Are you going to say, do you like the deal, do you not like the deal, or do you want to be in or out? I mean, in the end, then you have four questions. How does that pan out? The phrasing of a referendum is going to be very, very difficult as well.
And that's where it went wrong in the first place. People were voting for something that actually they hadn't been asked, I think. That was the issue.
And it was a deeply emotional thing. And I think Nigel Farage played a very clever game, because when you listen to him, yes, he spoke about Europe and there's bad people in Europe and the EU, but he also went against what I would say the toffs in very funny, because he's a toff himself, in Westminster. He said, look at all these people in Westminster. They haven't worked an honest day's work. Now, he had been a stockbroker. That can be honest day's work. I don't know. I used to be an investment banker, so maybe I should shut up. but he went in a sentiment of dissatisfaction with that ruling class, the Westminster ruling class, which again we come back to what you mentioned earlier, the dissatisfaction of those who govern us after the financial crisis. Mm.
Mm. And there's so much infighting between the two largest parties in the UK as well. So it's incredible. Instead of them like doing the job, whatever, they're dividing. You know, like the Labour Party, the Conservative Party, the same. I can understand in a way how the electorate would feel a bit, disenfranchised.
And if you go, if you're London centric, but if you go and speak to people, if you go and speak to people who may not read the newspapers every day and live somewhere out there, a lot of them say, I'm sick and tired of Brexit. Mm. Just enough already.
Time for just a very quick look on a story we've been reporting in our news bulletins. And this is about the Japanese author Haruki Murakami. So as people possibly know, there's an alternative to the Nobel Prize. The Nobel Prize was stopped for this year for literature because of a sexual misconduct scandal. So there's an alternative prize, and Murakami is one of those nominated. He's just said he's pulling out, doesn't want to be nominated.
Well, I think I have to say two things to that. Murakami is, obviously a brilliant novelist, sort of very Kafkaesque in his way, sort of how fatalistic he is, and alienation from from the powers that be. Yes. We're coming back to the same theme again. But I'm not surprised, having read him, and also, you know, Japanese authors tend to be sort of private and inward looking. I also think he's very clever, because at some stage he is for sure getting nominated, and if he's not getting the alternative one, he may get the real one. And frankly, I would like to get the real one.
Well, that's very true. Also on the list, I think Neil Gaiman is another big name on that list.
And Kim Thuy from Vietnam.
Yeah, and I think there's somebody
Marisa
Conde.
Yeah, Conde. Yeah,
from Guadeloupe. Very, very interesting list, and quite sad that there has to be an alternative, but great that it's not
yeah.
just.
No, it's
based
great
on
that the look, culture is important. Culture forms us, and it's important that cultural debate goes on, irrespective of some people doing not so good things.
Yeah, Cornelia, thank you so much for coming in. That's Cornelia Mayer. You're listening to Sunday Brunch. So, finally, I'm in Zurich today, but in fact I am just back from Stockholm, and I could pretend that I was there for high culture and hard politics, but the reality is that I just wanted to chat to Ingmarie Halling, who's the curator of the ABBA Museum. She started by talking about how she met the band.
I started working with this because I have a history with the band. I was doing makeup and costume and working on tours with them. They did the last tour in 1980. So after that, I worked with producing TV, sports shows and things like that for many, many years. And suddenly there was this lady doing the ABBA Museum in Stockholm back in 2008 or something. And I had a talk with her one day regarding an idea I had for her museum. And then she called me the day after and said, would you like to work as the producer for this museum? And, you know, if there's something I'm good at, it's saying yes. The band was not keen on having a museum because they felt that it's like what every person nearly thinks. The word museum is dull. It consists of glass boxes with little captions, and it's mostly about dead people. Finally, they said yes, and I think that's mainly because all the tourists coming to Stockholm until 2008 asked about the ABBA Museum. And the Swedish Tourist Board and everyone had to say, sorry, there is none. What? You don't have an ABBA museum. This country is ABBA. If you're all alone, when the pretty birds have flown, honey, I'm still free. Take a chance on me. So I guess the four members realized that, okay, yeah, we have to sort of deal with this. So make it good. I think they were quite happy with me working with it because it's friends of mine still, and I always been very true to the story and whatever I've done, so I guess they felt that this would be sort of more or less according to the story. I had one vision, and that was, of course, I have to say that I wasn't alone in this. We were an architect and a set designer and people like that. But I have the vision of doing a walk through their life, since there is quite a few original items. So I wanted to make sets and put the items in it, and then have the picture around the set, which means people walk from the early beginning of these four persons when they were four different artists all the way to the present, today. And if you have that vision, it's not difficult. You make rooms. You don't wanna hurt me, baby, don't worry. I ain't gonna let you. Let me tell you now. It has worked really well, I have to say that. It's above my expectations, really. And I'm happy that the four members really appreciate this place.
So they've been here, they've seen it?
Absolutely. I got to sing with Agneta in the karaoke booth where we're singing The Winner Takes It All.
I don't want to talk about things we've gone through.
And Frida was up on stage singing with herself in the hologram.
Now it's history. I played all my cards, and that's what you've done too.
Benny has actually been here like 5 times. And he used to send his friends and family and people who wants to know the story, and he doesn't want to tell them himself. He can sort of shove them off.
I was in your arms, thinking I belonged there. I figured it made sense, building me a fence.
Walk me through the exhibitions. So you come in and immediately there's an intro film.
It's a very famous and extremely skilled director called Jonas Åkerlund. He lives in Los Angeles and he's doing films for, you know, all the big bands, the big artists today. He loves ABBA. So he got all materials available, film material, and I said to him, just go wild. And he did. So much that when I actually saw the result, before it was finished, I was a bit scared and I thought, he's actually changing the songs because of his editing. But when Benny and Björn heard it, they totally loved it.
So after the film, what happens?
After the film, you come into the Swedish Folk Park, which is very unique for Sweden. It's a kind of a fun fair out in a park outside all the cities in Sweden. Where they have different stages, a big stage and a small stage. And all the bands that you have in Sweden, artists, singers, whatever, they can do their show there, their act. And some of the bands, they are touring the whole summer, playing 2-3 folk parks a day. So that's how they did their schooling.
Where do we go to after that in the museum?
And then we come to Brighton, 1974. The big moment when they won with the song Waterloo.
And this is Eurovision, of course.
Yeah. Absolutely, but it is their vision as well about the stage. We have done a sort of a replica of the stage with a set designer and replicas of the costumes so people can walk up and touch the fabric and stuff like that. Also have a bit about the historical context from the time, because Sweden was extremely left-wing in the 70s. It was crazy. The cultural establishment, they did not approve of ABBA. They said it was crap music and they wouldn't last, and they were commercial and they just wanted to earn money. And then we come into the touring part. One part is a dressing room. And that was originally the idea that I had for this woman who wanted to do the ABBA Museum from the beginning. I said to her, you should do a dressing room like it was on the tours. Show the audience how extremely not glamour-ish it was. Because it wasn't glamour. After that room with the dressing room, we have this fifth member stage, which is a hologram. And I think it's probably the hottest feature we have. People just love going up on that stage. And there is one mic stand between Björn and Agneta, so you get to stand there and sing.
Dancing queen.
today, because of the success of Mamma Mia and all these spin-offs, the museum, that they actually can allow themselves to think, wow, we did something really big and it was really good. And, you know, whoever you are, I think that the feeling to be able to think that is very comforting if you have gone through things, to look back and say, I did something really good, even though it's, you know, for me, it's not in that dimension. But I can look back at this exhibition maybe or something else and say, I did something good, at least. Can you hear the drums,
Fernando? What do you think about how ABBA has kind of come full circle in that, I mean, you were talking about in the 80s when Sweden was very left-wing and ABBA not very well-liked, and then thought to be deeply uncool, really, by the rest of the world for a lot of time in the 90s, that not really recognised, apart from in Australia and Zimbabwe. Suddenly, once again, they're back out there and everybody thinks they're fantastic. Why and how do you think that's happened?
Well, for me, there's only one answer on that. And I'm sure that you can ask so many people and they will have different answers. But for me, it's the music. Because they didn't appear in the 80s and still they came back. And that is what came back was the music. So there couldn't be any other answer to that. Good music is good music, even if it's Dvorak or if it's ABBA or whatever it is. If it's good, it's good. And I guess people just heard the music again and sort of, oh, this is good. I like it. There was something in the air that night. The stars were bright, Fernando.
They were shining there for you and me, for liberty. Fernando, what do you think?
I love that song. It's strange to say that it's my favorite song because it's my name. You know, it feels a bit narcissistic, but it is true. It is a beautiful song.
It's an amazing song. And you know, when you hear it all put together like that, and I have to say, George McDonough did a fantastic job putting that package together. When you hear all of their music, like, you remember again, these people were amazing.
And you could hear, you know, the curator saying she was talking about ABBA with so much love. You know what I mean? See, yeah. So she clearly has a very deep connection. So how was meeting with her, Georgina?
She was lovely. I'd sort of vaguely known her for a while.
Okay.
Anyway, but she, as you say, this very, very big passion for it. It's very much a labour of love for her, and she's constantly thinking of new ways to do it and invigorating the whole thing. And I mean, you've been through the museum, we've talked about this before, and sort of joining in with the holographic performance and taping yourself singing with them. You can do all sorts of quizzes. It's quite an extraordinary interactive experience.
No, absolutely. I think even if you don't like ABBA, you could still have fun there in some ways. But yeah, but that hologram, I mean, did you sing? Because I was very honest here on air that I did sing Mamma Mia in front of an American family that was clapping for me.
Yeah, I did, I have to say.
Did you have an audience?
I did.
Were they clapping?
They seem to be at least not covering their ears and screaming and running away in horror. So there is that.
And it's so funny about ABBA, they keep reinventing themselves, because now you see a lot of young people, you know, that probably, you know, they were not there when ABBA was at their peak, and they still enjoy it. Maybe it's because of the play, maybe it's because of the film. And there'll be a special later this year at NBC and BBC, right, with new songs.
Which is amazing, and a whole new audience, I think, being delivered to them. Don't you sometimes feel a little bit cross about the fact that you've been a loyal fan for 30 years through all the bad times, and suddenly everybody else finds ABBA trendy? You think, where were you when the world hated them?
I'm conflicted. I do agree with what you say, but at the same time I say, well, finally people, you know, they have taste now. Yeah, so finally. You know what I mean? It's not a boring kind of, you know, when you look at the charts, can we have a lot of boring stuff, Georgina?
Fernando, it's about time for us to pack you off to go swimming.
Yes, I have my swim trunks ready for the Utoken.
And then you're going to rush back and you're going to the airport, because that really is the kind of end of our weekend of broadcasting live from Zurich, isn't it? How's it been for you?
Well, it has been a pleasure. You know, I mean, come on, talking about swimming, wine, ABBA in Zurich, there's nothing better than that anyway.
It's true. And we also had a fantastic time with our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, who gave the brilliant at his party last night. It was a very good bash, and I think we can say that both his home and his new studio have been thoroughly warmed, don't you think?
No, and I love it. You know, it's my first time at the new Zurich HQ that we have. It's impressive seeing people outside, you know, and it's very sunny here in Zurich at the moment. I think it's going to hit 25 degrees today, Georgina. So people are, they have their dogs, they're having their espressos outside, reading the NZZ, perhaps. As Cornelia was saying, that's what you have to read if you're in Switzerland on a Sunday, a sunny Sunday.
Absolutely. And just we've got sort of mirrored glass here, and just watching people in the cafe out there in the sunshine, as you say, doing all of that and just really enjoying this bureau. If you are in this part of the world, I would urge you to come and have a look, because as well as the cafe, of course, there are all the newspapers. And then we're broadcasting from just behind in a little hidden spot. You might not know that we're just behind the glass.
We're like creepy, like looking at you.
That makes it sound sinister.
No, sorry.
Listen, we should go before perhaps we're even more indiscreet. Cheers.
Saúde. Can I say in Portuguese as well? Saúde. And you told me in Zimbabwe. How do you say it again?
Well, it's kind of, you know, makorokoto.
Makorokoto.
Listen, thanks to everybody involved with this edition of Sunday Brunch, produced by George McDonough and Rhys James. Studio managed by George in London and Rhys in Zurich. Our researcher was Mariana Lagrusta. And a special thanks to my co-host, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Coming up, Lila Foy on Midori House Sessions. And then from midday, Tom and Robert Bound bringing us the Monocle Weekly. But for me, Georgina Godwin, cheers and thanks so much and goodbye.